this is my chief worry as a conservative, that we have put so much power in the office of the presidency that someday the wrong man could come along. And I wouldn't be so concerned about whether he could use these powers to perpetuate himself in office, but how he would use these powers to destroy people that disagreed with him.
I am very willing to let the American public judge my physical and mental fitness. So today, I applaud China for stepping up. Excuse me, I applaud Canada.
Government is not our master, it is our servant. Its only power, that which we the people allow it to have.
Liberty Watch is an independent program on KVOI dedicated to the notion that government remains servant, not master, and operating in the public interest for which the media in this country was designed by exploring controversy. This helps us to resolve our differences peaceably, refining controversy into clarity through investigation, research, interview of experts, and public feedback. Liberty Watch is based in objective reason and is biased towards individual liberty, and so is not the view of the station or anyone but the host, guests, and callers. Liberty Watch operates outside the realm of political correctness, taking no notice at all of race, creed, religion, ethnicity, political affiliation, or orientation, focusing on content of character in eternal vigilance to the free flow of information about government, technology, current events, and our steadfast Constitution. The program is paid, produced, hosted, and operated by Charles Heller, and any mistakes are solely his responsibility. Speaking of responsibility, Randy Sutton is a 34-year law enforcement veteran and nationally known media commentator on law enforcement issues. He is the founder of The Wounded Blue, the national assistance and support organization for injured and disabled law enforcement officers. He served 10 years with the Princeton, New Jersey Police Department and 24 years with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, retiring at the rank of lieutenant, or as they say, lieutenant. He is recognized as one of the most highly decorated officers in Las Vegas Metro PD history, having won awards for valor, community service, exemplary service, and multiple life-saving awards. He has trained thousands of law enforcement officers in the United States on the subject of policing with honor, which will feature very frontally in this interview. Randy, it's the first time. Welcome to the microphones and telephones of Liberty Watch.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. As I like to tell people, I'm glad you could be had. So you served 35 years in law enforcement. What drove that?
Well, I love being a cop. I look back on it now and I can't believe how fast that time went by. I remember being the youngest police officer in the state of New Jersey at the time. They had just changed the age of majority from 21 to 18. So you could vote and you could drink and you could become a cop. But one thing you couldn't do, you couldn't buy ammunition because you had to be 21. So I actually got hired as a police officer at 19 years of age and was assigned to go to the New Jersey State Police Academy, one of the toughest residential academies in the country. And I had to have my mom go buy my bullets for me. And so that was my entry into the career, having mommy buy my bullets. And spent 10 years as a police officer in Princeton, which is where the university is. I was a Princeton Borough police officer, so I was actually in the town itself, and that was my hometown. So I was within my comfort zone, so to speak. Mm-hmm. But after 10 years of that, I was actually a detective at the time, top of my pay grade. I got so bored, I needed challenges. I really needed the action of what I wanted to accomplish as a cop. And so I heard that the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was a tremendous department. In fact, you know, this is actually going to be germane to our conversation. Mm-hmm. In that, when I made the decision to leave Princeton, I looked at a very large Southern Florida Metropolitan Police Department and tested there. And so I was now 30 years of age, 29, tested. And the way they worked the test was they had it set up for out-of-towners. So within a week, I took the physical, I took the written, I took the psychological. They had everything scheduled so that, you know, you could come down there and do the testing process within a short period of time, and they could make a determination whether or not they were going to hire you. So first day I get there, I take the written exam, I pass it. I take the physical exam, I pass it, and take the oral board the next day, I pass that. So they knew they were, unless something weird came up in my background, they were going to hire me. So they gave me the opportunity to do a ride-along, do a couple ride-alongs with them. And I said, I jumped at the chance, and I should, sure. So they paired me with a cop who had been a New Jersey police officer, I guess thinking we were going to do the New Jersey mind meld or something. And he came to pick me up in my hotel, and we went off on graveyard shift. And within, now this is no exaggeration, within an hour, we were involved in a high-speed pursuit with a motorcyclist. And this is back in the day where the pursuit policy was chase them till you get them.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike the restrictions of today. So we are the secondary unit, which means that we're behind the primary unit that began the pursuit. And this motorcycle, we're going 90, 100, 110 miles an hour chasing this guy. And we're in a fairly rural area of the city, or an industrial area. And I'm thinking, wow, this is exactly what I'm looking for. Yes, this is, you know, I'm in a pursuit. This is action, exactly what I was dreaming about. And we chased this guy, and his skill level was not what he thought it was. So as he rounded a corner, he lost control of the motorcycle and literally hit the side wall of a warehouse at about 85 miles an hour. And I mean, he exploded, the bike exploded, he was a red spot on the wall, and when the bike impacted, thousands of dollars, thousands of $20 and $100 bills started raining down from the heavens, because the bike was just packed with money. He was a drug courier. And literally, it looked like somebody took bushels of 20s and 100s and just threw them up in the air, and they were raining down on the smoking motorcycle and the dead body of this drug courier. And I'm soaking all of this in, and I'm going, wow, I'm going to get to see how the big boys really do an investigation like this. And we weren't on that scene for 35 seconds or a minute when the guy I was riding with said, okay, let's go. And I said, what do you mean, let's go? I said, you know, this is a major investigation. Aren't your detectives going to come out? And they're going to want to talk to us, right? He said, come on, we'll go. If they want us, they'll call us, come on. He couldn't wait to get me away from that scene.
Why?
And well.
Oh, so everybody else can pick up the money.
It's pretty obvious to me that all that money that came pouring out of the air did not make it into the appropriate places.
Right, yeah.
And so that was my first indication that what I call the ethical environment of that agency was not going to be consistent with mine. And what I saw over the next couple of days just reinforced that opinion. In fact, let me tell you the story of my last day with them. Now, I'd already made my mind up that I'm not joining this place because this place is crazy. But so it was like 4 o'clock in the morning, and there was a disturbance call, and it must have been quiet in that city because about 5 units show up for the disturbance. And the disturbance is this: you're Jack in the Box. You remember before Jack in the Box was the fancy restaurant that it is. I say that tongue in cheek. that it was just Jack's head on the post.
Right on the post.
You,
yeah.
And you, right, and you spoke into that tinny, you know, mouth. Yeah, exactly. Right. So, and of course, people that are doing that at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning are usually, you know, getting those tacos to soak up all that alcohol. So this guy was drunk and fell asleep while he was talking to Jack, ordering his tacos. And it was a line of cars behind him honking their horns. That was the disturbance call.
Uh-huh.
Right? So about five units show up. One guy drags the driver out of the driver's seat. Another cop gets in the car and drives it to the back of the restaurant. And now this guy's sleeping. He's unconscious, basically. He's, you know, so drunk. And one of the officers is pulling him from under his arms. And all of the cops, like, lined up. And I was watching this. I'm going, what the hell are they doing? And they just took turns running up to him and slapping him in the head. And I was like, I've seen a lot of stuff in my 10 years as a cop, but I never saw a sleeping man get his ass kicked before. That was the first time I've ever seen that. And they were very gracious. They offered me my turn, which I politely declined. And they all jumped, and then they threw him back in his car, and they all drove away laughing. So, as I said, that the ethical environment of that department was not consistent with mine, and I did not accept their job offer. And I was not surprised when several months later I read in the newspapers and I saw a photograph of the police chief getting taken out in handcuffs for corruption. So, you know, this is so that was a valuable lesson learned early on. And then I was actually telling that story at a Delaware Valley Detectives Association meeting in back at home. And after the meeting, two FBI agents came up to me and said, look, if you're looking to join a really good department with a lot of opportunity and doesn't have the same problems that you just talked about, Las Vegas Metro is hiring. And so I came out to Las
Vegas. Wow, that must have been in the days before the FBI had lost its credibility.
That was. Yes, it was. That's correct.
Hey, can I, I got to put you on pause here, or as we used to say at home, on puppy feet, because we're up on our first break. And this is fascinating. Not the interview I thought we were going to have, but probably a better one. So stand by with Randy Sutton of The Wounded Blue, and we'll be right back.
I'm Oliver North, and like you, I'm listening to Liberty Watch with Charles Heller, Tucson, Arizona.
This is Herman Cain. You'll get some good bargains on the Swap Shop on AM 1030, KVOI, The Voice, and have Charles make fun of your stuff.
1 Adam 12, no 1, Lincoln X-ray, Ida 483, 1 Adam 12, 415, Fight Group, with chains and knives.
And welcome back to Liberty Watch. Today we have the honor of having with us Randy Sutton. He served 35 years in Princeton, New Jersey, 10 years there, and 24 years in the Las Vegas Metro Police Department, 35 years of police service. And he founded an organization called The Wounded Blue, which we're going to talk about. But you were making a point about integrity and the way it didn't surprise you that police chief was being hauled off. Did you want to finish that thought?
Yeah, so when I just happened to be reading the newspaper and read a story about the chief being arrested, and it was photographed him being taken out in handcuffs, and I remember thinking, this is not surprising, because if the head of the snake or if the head of an organization is
corrupt,
it is of that nature, then the entire department can be corrupted.
Yeah, fish rots from the head.
And it's about leadership. It's all about leadership. And this is something I've seen over and over again as time has gone by about leadership in police organizations and how powerful it is in dealing with the ethical environment and the tenor of a police department.
Your grandkids have got to be about getting to hiring age. What would you tell them about going into law enforcement?
Well, To be perfectly honest, I don't have any. I have no children. I've never been married.
So I don't
have any. I've got some pseudo grandkids. People that.
All right. Well, if the grandchild of a friend came to you, knowing your reputation, and asked you if they should go into law enforcement, what would be your answer?
I say 100% yes. That as difficult as these times are, and I write extensively and I speak extensively on law enforcement issues in the media. Mm-hmm. As hard as these times are, this is now when people of courage and integrity really need to show that courage and join the police department. Now is not the time to run away. Now is the time to charge forward and be that leader. And all police officers are leaders. And as difficult as these times are, and believe me, I have this conversation very, very frequently with police officers from around the country who are literally in that category that you just spoke about, where their son or daughter is mm-hmm. Showing an interest, and they say, "Don't do it,
right?
Don't do it."
The police chief here has said that his kids are about to follow suit. Hey, can I pause you again? I've got a call coming in I want to take, and it's probably a question for you. And caller, your first name, please.
Oh, I'm David.
David, your comment or question for Randy Sutton, please.
Oh, well, I'm just interested in asking if he has any knowledge about the subversion of the police department. For many years, organized crime has been trying to make their way onto police forces, and whether or not...
Okay, that's an interesting question. Randy, especially in Las Vegas, where certainly there's no lack of organized crime, to what extent has organized crime made inroads into the law enforcement profession? You're breaking up. You're breaking up. If you're moving, stop. If you're not, move.
No, I'm sitting stationary.
Okay.
I can tell you that the organized crime, the mafia that used to have a big impact on this city is no longer barely has any impact at all. In fact, I worked one of the last cases where the mob actually tried to infiltrate the city, and the way a real attempt to take over the escort business here in Las Vegas. And you can imagine that many people think that prostitution is legal in Nevada.
Only in one county.
No, it's actually in a number of counties.
Oh.
But the law, it's not legal in Clark County where Las Vegas is.
Mm-hmm.
The law is that any, you can have a brothel, which is the only place that prostitution is legal, would be in a licensed brothel, and it has to be in a county that has a population of less than 50,000. So that's the criteria.
Okay.
So you have to actually drive quite a distance to go to a legal brothel here in Las Vegas. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a very vibrant and very visible girls direct to your room billboards up as soon as you drive out of the airport. So the question is, well, wait a minute. If prostitution is not legal here, then why are those signs up?
God bless the First Amendment.
And that's exactly what it is. That's exactly what it is. Escorts used to have to be licensed. They had to get a work card from the county. Well, some entrepreneurial escort service owner, this was back in the 80s, sued and said, wait a minute, this is a First Amendment right. They are entertainers. They're not escorts or entertainers. And he won. He won the case. And now there are no more escorts, quote unquote, in Las Vegas. There are only entertainers. And the way that they get by with their, quote, entertaining is that if you own the entertainment bureau, the quote unquote entertainment bureau, you have now have subcontractors who are the the prostitutes or the girls who are working for you. So you come into Vegas and you decide that you want to partake, and you call a quote entertainment service unquote. You make your I want a blonde who's 5'10" or whatever your particular taste is, and they say okay, she'll be there in about an hour. Give me your credit card number, and they bang your credit card for $300-400, and then they send the subcontractor to your room. They give her all your contact info, and whatever deal you take you make with that woman, that's up to you.
It's a private contract.
They don't get any of that money, because if they did, they would be pimping.
Yeah, that would be illegal.
They don't do that anymore.
Right.
So anyway, it's such a lucrative business that the mob said, "Hey, listen, we need to have a piece of that." So they made
literally,
literally, right?
Financially,
they made the decision. They were going to take over the entertainment service, and the way they were going to do it was they were going to kidnap one of the entertainment service owners and kill him, and they were going to torture another one, and that way they would
capitulate,
intimidate. Right. So they didn't know was that we were up on a wiretap when that was made over something completely different. But of course, now we're armed with that information, and I was actually in one of the surveillance vans when we watched, and the guy that they sent, this is funny as hell. The guy that they sent was called Vinny Aspirins, because he called Vinny Aspirins when he had a headache.
Right.
You can't make that up, right?
Yeah.
So anyway,
and his cousin Vinny Bag of Donuts. Anyway, were saying.
Yeah, right. So we popped them before they could actually take the actions that they had planned. And that was the last time that I know that the mob really tried to muscle in here. So really, in point of fact, the mob does not have any influence here in Las Vegas anymore in a major way.
Good. All right, Randy. That's good. David, go ahead.
Yeah, well, there was a specific thing. If you read the biographies of J. Edgar Hoover that came out in the 1990s, one of the aspects of it was that for example, the owner of a factory might show up in Vegas and put his factory up on the table, and he'll lose it. And organized crime can't officially do a corporate takeover of his factory, and they'll allow him to pretend to be the owner of it, but it's like hidden money, you know, for the mob.
It's a cover story.
Yeah, exactly. And so the issue came up whether or not a lot of American corporations with piles of stock, whatever, are really owned by the mob. And when you're talking about hiring police, new hires for police departments, whether or not they're informed about what they're walking into.
Okay, that's a good question, Dave. David, take your answer on the air. And Randy, be real brief with this one because we're over for a break.
Sure. Well, that really does not take place here. Those type of corporate shenanigans aren't really part of the landscape here.
Got it. That's real brief. All right. We're starting up on our bottom of the hour break. We're talking with Randy Sutton of the Wounded Blue. We will actually get into the Wounded Blue part of the topic in the next segment of the program, and we'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to Liberty Watch.
Sunday mornings, you can buy, sell, or trade anything lawful and moral on the Swap Shop.
Bunker is so funny. Is he married?
Bunker, call back.
It's Bunker, and I'm single, and I'm looking for a rich widow with a large ranch.
I've never even been on online dating. I believe in meeting people the old-fashioned way, alcohol and bad judgment.
She sounds like your type, Bunker.
Swap Shop, Sundays 10 to 11 a.m., right before Liberty Watch.
NYPD NYPD Blue for you there. Did you watch any of those shows, or did you find them trite?
I watched all those shows.
Really? Okay.
I grew up on Adam 12.
And, right. Yeah.
Loved it. I was a big fan of Pete Malloy and
Jim Reed. Right.
The fact that I can still remember their names gives you a little bit of shows you the impact that show had on me.
Right. There was some other interesting guest stars that appeared in that. One of them was Gary Crosby had a recurring role as kind of a composite jerk.
Oh, there was a ton of cameo appearances by actors and that wound up becoming very famous. Same thing as in Hill Street Blues was one of my favorites.
Yeah.
The best one of all was
Blue Bloods.
Called Police Story.
Oh, right. Police Story, 1974. Wamba. Yeah, by Joseph. There was the scripts were by Joseph Wamba. Those were phenomenal. That also had a really good theme music too. A lot of those ABC series had really good theme music to that. I'm gonna look up the story of the theme of Police Story while you're talking. But did any of them?
I can hum it for you right now.
Oh, I believe you could. You know that I would recognize it. You know, my favorite out of all of them though was Mannix, with Mike Connors. You remember
that was really a police drama. That was a detective thing. That wasn't a cop show.
Okay, yeah, but I mean, of that genre, of that general genre, but it wasn't a police procedural. You know, the one that I find fascinating is the current. Well, it's not current anymore, but Blue Bloods. That, to me, with the exception of a few technical mistakes, that seemed to me pretty real.
You know, I haven't really watched. I watched a few of those episodes, but I haven't watched television in years. So I'm at the modern stuff. I don't know anything about it. We got to go back to the 70s and 80s for me to have any knowledge.
Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to do it again. Christopher, you're on with Randy Sutton. Not the interview I thought we were going to do, but you go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Sutton, I commend you and thank you for your service and for having a long career and for ending it safely. So God bless you on that.
Well, he'll tell you about that, too, in a little while.
And then I'd like to weigh in. My favorite police show growing up was Blue Night with George Kennedy. That one just had grit, and it was that was such an awesome show.
It was also based on a Joseph Wamba story.
Exactly. It was based on a Joseph Wamba story, and that was a great one, too. I loved it as well.
Yep. All right. Let's talk about how you founded Wounded Blue.
Okay, so I did 10 years in New Jersey, 24 with Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And when I made the decision to move to Las Vegas, it was because I wanted more action. And remember the old adage, be careful what you wish for.
Yep.
You just might get it. And I wasn't off probation before I was in my first gunfight. When a 15-year-old tried to ambush me, and that luckily had a happy ending. I was in a foot pursuit with him. He crashed a stolen car, and it was like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I was in foot pursuit in a housing development, and I was close to him, but I couldn't quite grab him, and I had my gun in my hand, and as he went around the corner of a building, I came around the corner and he was waiting for me to shoot me. He was had the gun up waiting for me to come around the corner. And I instantaneously fired a shot at him when I saw the threat. And he was standing next to a stucco wall, and my shot grazed his ear and hit the stucco wall, and a piece of the stucco hit him in the head, and he thought he was shot. Mm-hmm. So he couldn't throw that gun down fast enough, and luckily I didn't have to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out he was 15 years old, a gangbanger. And, reality, Randy, this is what you signed up for. And that was only one of several shootings that I was involved in. and several others did not have as happy an ending, that did not end in injury or death. So I've had some life-changing experiences as a police officer, and some of those life-changing experiences, one of them included a gunfight that by all odds, I never should have survived.
Mm-hmm.
I did. It was literally a toe-to-toe gunfight. And why I survived and he didn't was a life-changing moment for me. And it gave me something, what I call the journey of why. Why mm-hmm. didn't I die that night? Why was I chosen to live? And let me tell you that that has a huge impact on the way you guide your life for the rest of your life. And so that actually played a role in where I am now and what I do now. So what ended my police career, I did not go out the way I thought I would. Mm-hmm. I had a stroke in my police car, and that ended my police career. It was literally the most frightening moment of my life. I was right on the Las Vegas Boulevard in front of Bally's Hotel. Was driving down the street, 2:30 in the morning. I was a lieutenant. I had a young officer with me, and I literally felt my brain slowing down. And I stopped the police car, got out to get around to the passenger side for him to get me to the hospital, and started speaking gibberish that I couldn't control, lost the ability to move, speak, and crumpled to the pavement, and lay there helpless while tourists walked by me and took my picture. Luckily, the clot went through my brain, but it ended my police career. Hmm. 3 weeks before that, my mother died in my arms. Hmm. 2 months before that, I was in another fatal shooting. So there was a lot of stuff going on in my brain and in my body. So it ended my career, and I what happened next was what really shocked me, and that was that my own department turned its back on me and just said, "We're not paying your medical bills, and we're not giving you your benefits. Have a nice life."
Why didn't they retire you? Why didn't they retire you?
I was eligible, but they couldn't stop my retirement. I could get my retirement, but they wouldn't pay my medical bills. And it's a workers' comp injury. So they fought me, and I literally went to see the sheriff who I'd served with for 24 years, and I said, "How do you treat me like this?" He said, "Randy, this isn't personal. It's just business." Well, that's what it was. Because you see, what I came to find out was they knew I was going to win the case. They also knew it would take well over a year of litigation.
Mm-hmm.
And what they were betting on was that I would die in the meantime and they wouldn't have to pay.
Mm.
That's a very harsh reality, especially as a dedicated police officer. I literally almost gave my life for my department and my community on more than one occasion. So when that happened, it was devastating to me emotionally.
Mm-hmm. They took away your trust.
It was a betrayal.
Right. Yeah. They took away your trust. Betrayal. Yeah.
And then, we haven't really had a chance to talk about all my other background, but I was the most featured officer on the TV show Cops. I was in movies like the movie Casino and Fools Rush In, and I've written 4 books. I actually have a 5th book coming out in a couple of months.
Hmm.
And I've been a trainer. I train cops all over the country. So because I was so visible in the law enforcement community, suddenly cops started reaching out to me. Not because I could do anything for them, but only because they knew who I was.
Mm-hmm.
And with these terrible stories, Randy, I was shot in the line of duty, and my chief never even came to visit me in the hospital. They're not paying my medical bills.
Mm-hmm.
Randy, I was struck by a car. I can't walk anymore, and they abandoned me. All from all over the country. And everyone said the same thing. I feel abandoned. I feel alone. And I realized that this is a national issue. Now, if you get killed in the line of duty, your family is going to be taken care of financially. You're going to get there's a great organization called Concerns of Police Survivors that will walk that road with your family, get you the benefits, provide peer support for forever. But if you get severely injured in the line of duty, you get catastrophically injured, you get disabled, there was nothing. And so I created it, and that is the Wounded Blue, and we are the National Assistance and Support Organization for Injured and Disabled Officers, and we've helped more than 13,000 injured officers, whether those injuries are physical or emotional and psychological, in the last 5 years.
Hmm. Well, on that note, we're going to take our final break of the hour, so bear with us for just a little bit.
This is Dennis Weaver, and you're listening to Liberty Watch. You know, the exchange of ideas is so important to maintain our freedom in this country, and Liberty Watch is a show that promotes freedom.
And welcome back to the last segment of Liberty Watch today with Randy Sutton of the Wounded Blue. He's an officer who served for 34 or 35 years? 34?
34.
Yeah, 34 years and retired honorably and with medically from a stroke which happened actually on duty. And then due to the department not being supportive, started a foundation called the Wounded Blue to take care of people in his circumstance. How many officers do you serve, or former officers?
Well, since we launched, which was a little over 4 years ago, we've helped more than 13,000 police officers.
Huh. So you've helped as many people as were on the Chicago Police Department.
It's an astounding number. Now, what we provide is a lot of different services. Peer support is our number one. So my entire team is made up of officers. Everybody on my team has been either shot, stabbed, beaten, run over, screwed up and screwed over, or faced serious post-traumatic stress issues and come out on the other side.
By the way, I looked at your board. Pardon my interruption. I looked at your board. What a phenomenal group of people.
Oh, I do. I have an amazing board. So very, very caring individuals. Mm-hmm. The team itself, I have officers who have been blinded. I have officers who are in wheelchairs. I have officers who have just, you know, face such incredible stress and pain, and yet they continue to serve, and they're the real heroes of the Wounded Blue. They're the men and women who literally touch lives and save lives. I can't even tell you the number of officers who we have, who once they knew that there were people that cared about them, put suicide away, and that's a very real issue in law enforcement. We have a tremendous suicide rate, and much of it is because of the way these officers are being treated by their own police departments. And chiefs and sheriffs hate me when I say this, but that's the reality. And I'm not going to sugarcoat it in order to be politically correct either. That very often the stresses that are imposed upon our own officers are imposed upon them by administrations who don't care about them. And so,
they should work in radio.
Yeah, you're probably right. So it's a situation that we now. On the other hand, there are a lot of caring chiefs. In fact, we're about to give an award to a chief at our major fundraising event coming up in July, because he is such an incredible supportive individual leader who has taken these challenges of officers who are suffering and shown incredible compassion and empathy. So it runs. You got to remember, there's 17,000 different police agencies in this country. Every one has a different chief or sheriff. Everyone has a different administration. They have different rules. So there's a lot of issues here with the fact that there are 17,000 different leaders. Mm-hmm. And every one of them, makes their own rules.
Right, yeah. Well, we have a similar circumstance. We had an in-custody death of a guy who had a huge amount of drugs on board. And it was naked and was assaulting his grandmother. She called the police. And they were just three officers. They were trying real hard to subdue him nicely. They finally got him handcuffed. And they laid him down, and they didn't sit him up in the recovery position. And that wasn't the cause of his death, because the guy had so much drugs on board that he died anyway. And they made a mistake, but it wasn't a fatal mistake. And then the department investigated him and said they didn't break any major rules. They may have made a procedural error, but didn't result in the death. And then the chief came in because of political pressure and fired all three of them. and he majorly depressed the, I mean, that was just one of many, many things he did. And then later that chief got elevated ahead of the Border Patrol, and he helped do for the Border Patrol what he'd done for Tucson. And I'll tell you that Tucson's gain was the nation's loss when they moved him up.
I'm very familiar with that individual, and he's the kind of police leader that is disgusting to me.
Yeah,
that's the kind of police leader that draws for political expediency.
Right.
Will throw his own people away, and I can't. It makes me sick to know that there are leaders like that in our law enforcement community.
Yeah. All three of those cops went to other departments and are doing great. So anyway, they actually benefited from leaving. But I got to tell you, this is a friendly interview, and at the same time, nobody gets a free pass on Liberty Watch, Randy. So I got to tell you, in the last few years, some members of law enforcement have not done the profession any credit, especially like Amber Geiger killing the man when she thought he was in her apartment and he was in his own. She was on the wrong floor. And a Minnesota officer who killed a man with her service weapon thinking it was a taser. And Florida Deputy Eddie Duran, who just shot and killed a really honorable airman who answered the door with a gun in his hand, pointed at the floor. And, you know, I could go on and on, but you get the point. Is that part of what's leading to the way cops are treated, the public losing their faith in some departments? Not all, but some.
So this is a lot more complicated issue than
we can't get to in 5 minutes.
Right. But many of these issues are because of the lack of training that these officers are receiving now. The officer who mistakenly used her weapon instead of her taser. I mean, that to me, she should never have gone to prison. What she did was a major screw up, but there was no intent there. There was training issues there, and so yet because of the tenor of the situation now, she was put in prison. And that, to me, was a miscarriage of justice.
I respectfully disagree. I think when the negligence that a person engages in, whether it's their training or not, when the negligence amounts to, it's one thing when it's a mistake, but when negligence amounts to the death of a human being, I think there has to be criminal culpability for it.
Well, I couldn't disagree with you more. And let's put it this way. If that officer had chosen to use her firearm under the circumstances, the same set of circumstances, she would have just been justified in killing him.
I don't know that to be true. I don't think he was resisting to that level. I don't think it was a deadly force incident, because if it was, she wouldn't have had she wouldn't have thought she needed to use the taser. So even in her judgment, it wasn't a.
That's incorrect.
Okay.
That's incorrect.
Correct me.
Many officers are failing to use deadly force in the appropriate time because they are afraid of the consequences of the political ramifications. We have cops now that are dying in the line of duty. We have cops now who are being severely injured in the line of duty because they didn't use deadly force when they should have. And the reason that they have not is because they are afraid of being the next victim of a system that is willing to throw a police officer away for political expediency. So the fact that in her case, she used her taser, or she used her weapon trying to use a taser. Mm-hmm. And in that set of circumstances, and remember, all of these are subjective decisions made within seconds. Those decisions are based on what that officer's thoughts are as far as the threat to them. It doesn't have to be real.
No, it has to be what would a reasonable officer do given that set of facts.
Exactly.
I understand that. I've been teaching the use of force, certified to teach the use of force for 30 years by the state of Arizona, and I understand the standards. I understand them very, very well. Now, albeit from a civilian standpoint, but I still understand there's a difference between a civilian standard and a law enforcement standard. Notwithstanding that, if you have the power of life and death in your hands, and you use it in a way that isn't justified, there has to be criminal culpability. Because if there isn't, the natural result of it is you end up with a force that, number one, you end up with a public that isn't safe, and number two, you end up with a public that doesn't trust law enforcement. And I want the public to trust law enforcement because I want them to be trustworthy. I don't think anybody in Pima County trusts the current sheriff to do the right thing. I don't think even people in his own political party, I don't think they trust him. And that's a bad circumstance for the officers, and what happens as a result of what Amber Geiger did is bad for the cops, as well as being bad for the recipient of the bullet.
No one is infallible.
No.
And the fact of the matter is that when you want to assign criminal culpability, which is your words, criminal culpability,
right,
for officers that make decisions that lead to death or serious bodily injury for an individual that in their mindset that they believe was a threat or because of some tragic accident, you want to find them criminally culpable. That is wrong. That's why there are civil remedies. That's why there are civil lawsuits. That is designed to create the justice for those victims and for those victims' families when there are errors made. But you're just saying, well, let's put them all in jail.
No, excuse me, Randy, that's not what I said. And it is wrong. It is a libel to put words in another person's mouth. I did not say that at all. What I said was that we're about to run out of time. We need to have this. Are you available at this time next week?
I have to check my schedule.
Check your schedule. I'd like to continue this in 1 week. I have to go. We're at the top of the hour, and I have another guest booked, and he's going to be calling in and getting a busy signal. I have to leave it at that. AM 1030, KVOI, Cortero, Tucson, The Voice. Stay tuned for America Armed and Free.